Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, everybody. Very warm welcome to this session of Consumers International Fair Digital Finance Forum. In this session, we're going to be looking at building the digital finance regulation we need. Just before we get into the details and then onto the session, just a little reminder that you're very welcome to add questions or comments in the session. And if you could please use the chat function to do that, that will help me to direct questions to the panel. And when you're using the chat function, please remember to introduce, say who you are, which organization you're from, and where you're, you know, where you're joining from, which jurisdiction you're joining from. That would be very interesting and helpful. If we go to the next slide. So as I said, this session is all about building the digital finance regulation we need. It's part of the Consumers International Fair Digital Finance Forum this year, which obviously coincides with World Consumer Rights Day on it's tomorrow. The objectives of this session are to share successful approaches to digital finance regulation that protected and empowered consumers during the COVID-19 pandemic. Particularly, we want to have a think about what have we learned over the last 2 years and how will this help us mitigate the future challenges on the horizon in the digital finance marketplace. It's very much, of course, aligned to the overall theme of this year's forum. And of course, it goes without saying that digitalization has massively increased over the last couple of years in the context of the pandemic and touches the lives of almost every consumer, wherever they are around the world. If we go to the next slide, please, Ruby. So I'm Miles Larby. It's my pleasure to be acting as moderator for this panel. I'm the head of financial consumer protection at the OECD. And I lead the OECD's research, policy, and standard setting work in relation to financial consumer protection, working with governments right around the world, OECD, G20, FSB member countries, but also, as I say, countries in every continent around the world. And it's my pleasure to be moderating the session. And at the OECD, we work and collaborate with Consumers International on relevant topics. And it's our pleasure to do that and to support Consumers International in this initiative as part of this year's forum and related initiatives as well. For example, the Fair Digital Finance Accelerator that I know is going to be showcased during the course of this week. If we go to the next slide, I'll just briefly introduce our panelists. I'm delighted to be joined by four excellent panelists from jurisdictions around the world. We have Kirti Ramsahok Hirasingh, Head of Regional Centre of Excellence from the Financial Services Commission of Mauritius. Jose Vasco, who is the Director of Investor Protection and Education at the Securities Commission of Brazil. Supriya Sial, who's the Deputy Commissioner at the Financial Consumer Agency of Canada. And Adam Wright, Senior Counsel, California Department of Financial Technology Innovation. So a really interesting panel with bringing perspectives and experiences from countries right around the world to explore this issue of the digital financial regulation that we need. I'm just going to start by a few scene setting comments, if you like, drawing on work that the OECD has conducted at an international policy level on this topic of digitalization and how the experience of the pandemic has perhaps accelerated digitalization and some of the impacts of that and how different governments around the world have responded. So if we can go to the next slide, please, Ruby. I'm going to draw from and just briefly mention some of the highlights from a major piece of work that the OECD conducted last year in collaboration with the G20 to look at the impact of the pandemic on financial consumers and the range of policy measures that were put in place by countries around the world, the lessons learned and the effective approaches. And if we go to the next slide, please, Ruby. This report, which is available on the OECD website, of course, is the result of a very significant amount of data collection and analysis of information that we collected from governments from over 80 countries around the world, as you can see on this map, and public authorities in those 80 countries from 160 public authorities from those 81 jurisdictions. So a very comprehensive picture of the global situation, the global response. And if we go to the next slide, please, Ruby. The first finding I wanted to highlight was, as I say, based on all that data collection and analysis, we identified the leading risks that were faced by financial consumers arising from the pandemic. And you can see them on this slide. We've broken these risks down by high income countries and lower middle income countries, because I think there's an interesting picture that emerges that you can see the number one risk for financial consumers in lower middle income countries was reduced financial resilience. For high income countries, the number one risk to consumers identified was vulnerability to financial scams and frauds. Now, those risks were common across the board, but certainly you can see the picture of different risks arising to consumers. And obviously it reflects in some part the level of infrastructure and policy arrangements in place, as well as capacity for responding to hardship in different countries around the world. If we go to the next slide, please, Ruby. Obviously, one of the most significant impacts from the pandemic was the accelerated digitalization of financial services, and that's obviously the focus of today's session. So again, just by way of background, you can see that countries told us that increased use of digital financial services, payment or transaction products, digital wallets, QR codes, contactless cards, that was one of the most significant impacts that they saw. In over three quarters of responding countries, the limits for contactless payments on cards was increased, sometimes up to 200%. And of course, we can see that digitalization played a very important role in mitigating the impacts of the pandemic, because people were able to continue to transact and access their financial services. But at the same time, it of course created the increased risk that people who can't or don't want to transact digitally, whether it's because of low digital capability, low financial literacy, or lack of access or infrastructure, of course, there's a risk of increased exclusion for those people in different places around the world. If we go to the next slide, please, Ruby. More than half of countries put in place specific measures to support the financial inclusion or the digital financial inclusion of consumers in their country. That included particularly expanding government payment services, both payments to the government and payments from the government, by means of digital means. There were new rules brought in on terms of your client due diligence requirements to adapt to the digital environment. And the next slide, please, Ruby. We can also see here that a number of policy or regulatory changes were introduced in terms of financial consumer protection. And the most common measure that was introduced were measures to support consumers experiencing financial hardship, financial difficulty, as a result of the impact of the pandemic, whether it's as a result of job losses, business opportunity losses, reduced unemployment and income levels. And this is obviously a very significant development and one that we think is very important looking ahead, the importance of having quick and responsive hardship mechanisms for consumers suffering financial difficulty. And we could just jump to the next slide, please, Ruby. This slide just summarizes the lessons that are summarized in that report. And if we go to the next slide, which just in terms of our work looking ahead, and I know we're going to also be discussing this through the course of this panel, this report is available on the website, as I say, so I'd encourage people to go and have a look at it. All of the data and the results are there. And importantly, these lessons are going to feed into the review of the G20 OECD high-level principles on financial consumer protection that we're currently undertaking, and also inform, and say that the findings of the research are available to inform the work of all other stakeholders and those who want to do deep dives into particular issues that arose or are still arising as a result of the pandemic. So that's all I wanted to say by terms of scene setting to paint the global picture. And now I think we could come to our panel and get some perspectives from panelists on their individual jurisdiction experiences and the lessons they'd like to share with everybody. So let me start by asking, I've got a few questions ready and hopefully we'll have, as I say, time for questions through the chat. But let me start with this question. Thinking about the COVID-19 pandemic, what has been the main impact in your jurisdiction and the key policy responses for financial consumers that were implemented? And in your opinion, in your experience, what were the main risks that consumers were facing? And I'd like to put this question first to Adam, please, if I may. Adam.
Sure, thank you. My name is Adam Wright. I'm an attorney with the California Department of Financial Protection and Innovation. Here in the United States, I specifically work in the Office of Financial Technology Innovation. And you're right, great question, Miles, and terrific research. Thanks for presenting that. I think we've seen very similar results as your research shows. And I think number one that we've seen is a real need for consumer awareness and education. In the United States and in the state of California, we've had a number of consumer relief programs that have been launched by the federal government and the California government. And I think given because of all of the news over the last 2 years about COVID, the war, and everything else happening, is that it's been difficult, I think, for consumers to understand some of the line level details about some of the changes to lending programs or relief programs that have been available to consumers. And we have felt that one of our primary goals should be to help informing consumers about these new programs. And so we've undertook a number of education efforts. In particular, to help folks understand some of the new benefits available to borrowers, understanding that how they can take advantage of foreclosure programs or for student loan forgiveness programs that have been rolled out throughout the state of California and in the federal government. And it looks like that was a similar research finding that the OECD found as well. And so I think that's definitely something here that we have felt that is really important as a regulator in these times. It's just making sure that consumers are aware of their options. And we have actually engaged with our licensees. We've engaged with our lenders who are authorized to operate in California to make sure that they are offering these programs to consumers and to make sure that they're making them aware of them. And we've required that as part of our examinations and in our oversight of these companies. And so that's really one of the key takeaways from us.
Great. Thank you, Adam. And I think that is a really important point. That putting measures in place is only half the story if consumers need to be able to understand them and use them appropriately. Kirti, what was the experience from the Mauritius perspective?
Sorry, can you hear me, Miles?
Yes, perfectly.
Okay, I was just muted. So thank you for that robust, like Adam said, terrific presentation and research on the digital finance and consumer rights. So one key observation about the COVID pandemic was that it was obviously unforeseen and abrupt when situations like the lockdown was applied in Mauritius. So this meant that the financial systems, particularly the banking and the payment systems, had to adapt overnight to the new means of doing business, especially electronically. So basically the consumers at large could not be prepared in advance, nor could there be situations of training or information being provided to them. Therefore, in the case of COVID-19, the main situation that arose, especially for Mauritius, was that there was an overnight shift from a largely cash-based society to an electronic means with the problem on both sides. That is, the consumer side, there was lack of preparedness, and on the merchant side, there was also lack of preparedness who were not fully prepared to go online. At the same time, there was the delivery channel, which was the missing link in Mauritius. So we should not forget that Mauritius is a very small island, and therefore online purchase was not something which was a regular practice. So in short, the delivery of services was not fully functional. Furthermore, during the COVID-19, we went through an overnight lockdown for about 3 months. And that lockdown meant that even the movement of people and the delivery channel were controlled, there was a number of disruptions coming in these areas. And this brings to my other point as well, that following those disruptions, many organizations' business continuity plans did not cater for COVID, as there were no free movement of people. Hence, both the consumers and operators had to operate in this situation. Also, this brings me to my last point, where the government had to come up with the work from home concept. And this was not part of our culture. So it was very difficult for people who are less IT skilled or technology savvy to adapt to this new culture. So coming up to the part where you say, who are more vulnerable? So in the Mauritian context, we saw that the youngsters were more adaptable to the tools rather than the senior citizens, because they were more skilled in IT. And during that time, with the work from home concept, buying everything online, so we had to use smart devices, and for senior citizens that was difficult. I think that brings to my the end of your question.
Thank you for sharing that, Kirti. Yes, that is that issue about the sort of the sudden shift to business continuity plans, which probably weren't hadn't been developed with this in mind, I think is an incredibly important one. And no doubt the experience of that will inform how businesses prepare those plans sort of, you know, into the future. And thank you for sharing that insight on the most vulnerable consumers. I think that sort of echoes that point about, you know, the potential. While this digitalization was, of course, incredibly important, it also did create this risk of new pockets or new cohorts of exclusion in populations. Which I know we'll explore it further in just a moment. Vasco, can I ask for your perspectives from Brazil, please, on this question?
Thank you very much, Miles, for the question. And also, I'd like to thank Consumers International and OECD for the invitation. I'm pleased to be here and to hear such a diverse panel with different perspectives. On my perspective as a security regulator, I think it's important to mention that the main impact for financial consumers and perhaps investors, retail investors during the pandemics are, I think I can mention four. The first one is the flight to yield instead of the flight to quality, which is more common in uncertainty times in the past, contrary to our assumptions. We saw a huge number of retail investors trying to invest in riskier investments during the pandemics, even during the worst times. In Brazil, for example, we moved from 500,000 investors, retail investors in the stock exchange, to 5 million investors in just 2 years. So it's an unprecedented in scale, and clearly, investors were looking for high, riskier investments. There also, another point that I think it's important, it's gamification of investing or financial services. This is partly due to the fact that the broker dealers and even financial institutions are offering actually some services for free. So commissions have fallen or been eliminated at all. And apps and trading platforms are making investment easy. So with that, the incentives changed. So there is a huge incentive for trading. And of course, the financial service needs to be paid by the end of the day. So there are different incentives with new participants actually paying for the flow of orders. So a lot of incentives to people to trade, even in some investments that are not good for themselves. So we saw the meme stock phenomenon during the COVID. I can mention, I think it's well known, the GameStop surge in 2021, last year, SEC published a report on the causes of this phenomenon and how to address it. There are some considerations about market infrastructure incentives that are very good, but just to mention that the investors that were trading options moved from $58 million on January.
I'm not sure if it's just me, but Vasco seems to have frozen.
Yeah, I think we've lost Vasco Mars. I'll try and work out the background.
Okay, thank you, Matt. I think we got a couple of key insights from Vasco there before that happened, which is very interesting. And what I want to do is drill into this a bit further and come to you, Supriya. Kirti, you touched on this issue about consumers who may have been particularly vulnerable or considered to be more vulnerable as a result of the impacts of COVID-19 on their personal financial situation. Supriya, I was just wondering if you could share with us your perspective on that from Canada, please.
Thank you. And I'll also say thank you for inviting me to this session. Pleasure to be here with all of you. I work for the Financial Consumer Agency of Canada. Our mandate is to protect financial consumers. So we have been closely monitoring changes in Canadians' financial well-being through the pandemic through a monthly nationally representative survey that we started in August of 2020 and continue to field to this day and intend to continue fielding until the after times of this pandemic. One day they will come. And our findings show a significant impact of the pandemic on all Canadians, as other speakers were alluding to. Specific to vulnerable populations, I'll say two things. So first, about one-fifth of Canadians report that they have been affected by a bank branch closure. Now, it is generally true that it is lower income or more vulnerable consumers, such as those with a disability, who are most affected by bank branch closures. And that is what we find in our data linked to the pandemic as well. And as you were saying at the beginning, Miles, the pandemic, of course, has accelerated the move to digital. It was already occurring, but the pandemic has acted as a catalyst, if you will. And while digital banking, of course, brings many benefits, it is typically also true that vulnerable groups, such as those with low digital access or low digital literacy, seniors, for example, are the people who are most likely to bank in branch, and those are the groups that get left behind. Second thing I'll say is while over half of Canadians report an increase in stress linked to their finances, this was especially true among women in our surveys and also others with part-time or precarious work, which again, I'll say is not surprising because economic shutdowns and slowdowns most often impact people already living on low incomes, and women in particular are more likely to work in fields with precarious positions and low incomes. The last thing I'll say is we think of financial vulnerability as a state rather than a trait, and any and all demographics can find themselves in a state of vulnerability as this pandemic has revealed. At the same time, systemic barriers have led to some groups being especially susceptible to negative financial outcomes. And those are the groups we see as the most vulnerable in the data that we have. So we continue to monitor, share our data with anybody who wants it so that we can collectively learn and adapt our approaches.
Thanks, Supriya. And that's a very generous offer to share your data, and maybe some of the attendees on the call might want to get in touch with you because having data is just so important. And interesting, not, I guess, surprising that you, Kirti and yourself have both mentioned people with low access, digital literacy, particularly elderly, in terms of this digital transformation, if you like, or acceleration as a result of the pandemic. I want to sort of stick on this theme of sort of the response to the pandemic, but perhaps now look more at the role or your experiences of industry responding to the pandemic, and sort of certainly from the viewpoint as a regulator or a conduct supervisor. One of the things that we found in our research was that your many governments, supervisors, and industry participants or industry associations work together in some ways to try and ensure that the response to the pandemic was coordinated. But of course, a lot of the frontline measures were being implemented by industry participants. And Adam has already highlighted the issue of perhaps measures being implemented and the consumer understanding of that. I want to ask about what have you seen in terms of really positive responses from industry participants in terms of assisting consumers during the pandemic? And of course, conversely, and as a supervisor, this is sort of goes with the territory, have you seen any instances of misconduct or unfair practices from industry participants in this sort of context? And Supriya, I'd like to sort of continue with you on this question first, if I may. Thank you.
Yes, thanks, Amal. So we've been encouraging our regulated entities, banks, to find ways to ensure that consumers continue to have access to financial services at reasonable cost. So early in the pandemic, at the behest of the Minister of Finance here in Canada, banks in Canada provided a number of relief measures. And we, FCAC, asked for and received weekly data reports from the regulated entities on these measures. So a few pieces of data, you know, payment deferrals were granted on 775,000 mortgages, lowered interest rates, fee refunds, or payment deferrals on about 650,000 credit cards, payment deferrals or lowered interest rates on around 500,000 auto loans, personal loans, or lines of credit. So the data we received from the banks also show that while each regulated entity had its own qualifying criteria, consumer requests were generally approved in a timely manner. Most consumers who applied for financial assistance from a bank received it in some way, provided you know their account was in good standing and they self-declared that they had been negatively impacted. Now, in addition to the data that the banks gave us, we also conducted a monthly survey to understand consumers' use of banking products and services. And this ran from July of 2020 to April of 2021. So our last round of data is what I'll refer to now. And that showed that about 54% of Canadians reported receiving information from their banks on COVID-19. And nearly two-thirds reported being aware of financial assistance being offered by banks. And based on the same survey, we also know that the strongest predictor of taking financial assistance was a decrease in income. At the same time, 31% of Canadians, about a third, also reported paying additional bank fees because of the COVID-19 pandemic. And our data show that it was lower income vulnerable Canadians who were most likely to pay fees such as overdraft fees or non-sufficient fund fees.
Thank you, Supriya. Adam, can I turn to you next, please, for the perspective from California?
Yeah, of course. When it comes to industry participants responding positively to the challenges of COVID-19, the industry we think comes top of mind to us here in California has been the response from our non-bank residential mortgage providers and servicers. One of the things that happened here in the United States and in California in particular is that residential mortgage loan origination essentially doubled during the pandemic. Because of low interest rates, consumers made a rush to refinance their existing home mortgages, while at the same time, due to government edicts and regulatory pressure, our servicers were essentially had to stop foreclosing upon homes. So if a borrower defaulted upon their obligations, they were not allowed to foreclose. And even when it came to renters, there was obligations for landlords and these other providers to offer assistance before they took any steps for eviction, even when the eviction moratorium was lifted. And so even while we saw residential mortgage loans double, right, the activity was off the charts. we saw some very interesting statistics on the complaints and the foreclosures. So there's a 68% decrease in foreclosures, even after the foreclosure moratoriums were lifted. And we saw a 19% decrease in complaints. And so it's been interesting as a regulator to respond to this, because a lot of our traditional activity and oversight was to the mortgage industry. And so now we see mortgage industry complaints reduced. In conjunction with that, we saw a huge drop in our payday short-term lending product volume. That dropped 40% during the pandemic, largely because of access to other government programs, stimulus checks, loan forbearances. And really, I think critical is, you know, payday loans in California are something that folks are typically a brick and mortar. You walk down to a local store to get a short-term loan. And we saw a real growth in what we call alternative financing options, stuff like buy now, pay later, or earned wage access. And so we've really seen a shift from traditional mortgage and payday to kind of a new world of digital finance. And we've had to kind of recalibrate our focus accordingly.
That's so interesting. Thank you, Adam. I guess interesting to see if the low mortgage complaints continues sort of, you know, in the years to come, particularly with that significant and massive increase in people taking out mortgages. And it's interesting to flag buy now, pay later. I guess, you know, a lot of regulators and supervisors have paid so much attention to payday lending, rightly, because of the risks. And as you say, perhaps that's gone down in terms of demand, but buy now, pay later is not exactly free of risks to consumers either. So it's sort of shifting the distribution channel is changing, but the risk profiles are still there. That's very interesting. Thank you. And Kirti, from the Mauritius perspective, what have you seen in terms of industry practice, both good and bad?
Like Supriya said, well, the pandemic brought unprecedented response and collaborations among the operators at large, whether it is the regulators or the operators. So basically in the banking system, it was announced and we did see that there was a collaboration among banks to allow for interbank payment withdrawals to be carried out without any additional charge. And this was meant for people to be able to withdraw money at the ATM at their proximity without any cost. At the same time, a number of sessions were held and people were informed on the way of the behavior that consumers should be, especially the more vulnerable ones, with respect to adopting modes of electronic payments. Moreover, like Supriya said, the government came forward with payment deferrals, and there was extension in payments for utilities and rentals. There was automatic renewal of insurance policies expiring with premium being paid after. Also, according to statistics, there was a large pickup of electronic payment means during this period. And irrespective of the previous behavior, whether behavior could be more of a conservative one, or that whether that behavior could be more of a cost-conscious side, especially for small retailers who initially complained that the charges related to card payment was very high. But at some point in time, it basically forced all the players together into that route. And in terms of unfair practices, these were more seen into retail businesses, which were more cash dominant because prices were hiking. In some instances, we saw that people tend to create artificial scarcity, and that was shown. And at the same time, there was an upsurge of attempts for electronic fraud. So some statistics showed that people were drawn towards card phishing, but thankfully, regulators came up to do some financial literacy with respect to the minimum behavior that people need to adopt during this period.
Thank you. I think that issue of fraud is a very interesting one, and there may be questions on that in a while. I mean, I think around the world, we've seen a massive increase in online frauds associated with the pandemic. Associated with the pandemic and the fact that, you know, so many more people are transacting online, it's been a key risk. As we move on to, I don't see any questions in the chat yet. So a reminder to attendees, feel free, if you have a question, to pop it in the chat and I can ask it to our panelists. But we have plenty of questions and discussion points to be getting on with. And I want to now start sort of thinking about looking ahead, sort of where do we go from here? And particularly thinking about regulatory or supervisory changes that have been implemented as a result of the pandemic experience. So what changes were put in place in response to these this situation? And Adam, I'd like to come back to you on that, please, if I can.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, one of the major changes I think that we are we foresee and that we're planning to implement, we're already trying to put resources behind, is stepping up our response to consumer complaints. During the pandemic, I mean, even though we've had a drop in activity across some of our traditional financial lines like mortgages and payday, we have still seen a 40% increase in complaints throughout the pandemic. So really just a surge of complaints. I think as many of the panelists have spoken about already, just a very rapid shift to more digital finance products have really led to more complaints. You know, in particular, some of the hottest areas that we've seen complaints are student loans. That's been a very big one for us, is student loans. People with complaints about how their student loans are being serviced and whether or not they're complying with the new rules for the pandemic on how student loans should be collected. All personal loan products. As I mentioned before, we've really seen a shift from kind of more traditional loans to these new alternative loans. And that raises many questions for consumers who might not understand how these new products work. And so one of the things in California we're trying to do, in addition to monitoring our complaints, is we are really trying to step up our sharing of regulatory expectations with providers on these new products. A very popular thing has been in the digital world has been to create new, seemingly new products. And so we have seemingly new products like Buy Now, Pay Later, Earned Wage Access. We also see a rise in income share agreements, which are loans which are supposed to be tied to income. We've also seen a big rise in a product called a shared mortgage appreciation product, through which a consumer sells, quote unquote, a percentage of the upside in their home equity. And we've also seen a really large number of complaints related to cryptocurrency. And so one of the things we're really trying to do is step up sharing with these providers what we think the rules of the road are in California. So that, you know, we're not dealing with it 2 to 3 years down the line. We want to get in front of it, understanding where the market's going, sharing expectations in advance, and really informing what we share with providers based upon a really good review of complaints. You know, letting our folks, our citizens, tell us quickly what the issues they see, what are they encountering, and then turning that back around and turning that into guidance for providers to help avoid some issues. And we've also, you know, as Jose mentioned earlier, we've had a number of complaints arising relating to questionable investments and fraudulent schemes. We've definitely seen an increase in that. I think just the move to digital allows folks who might not have been on digital platform previously to be more easily taken advantage of, I would suspect. And so we're really stepping that up. In particular, we have seen an increase in the amount of consumers who have been victimized by quote unquote debt relief companies or debt relief agencies. These are companies which purport to negotiate or erase or remove or modify existing debts of consumers for a fee. Oftentimes nothing gets done and they're just built for fees. And so we've really stepped up our enforcement of that, going after companies who do that, who provide fake illusory services without any benefit and making sure that they're not doing that. So that's been a real area of focus for us too. We posted a number of consumer alerts relating to scams involving fake federal and state stimulus payment programs. We've had a number of consumer alerts that have been directed to scammers who sent out fake default notices in order to collect money from consumers. And also just a number of kind of your typical investment scams like fake private placement offerings. And so, you know, in addition to that, like I said, we're stepping up our complaint review. We've increased our staffing. We've increased our review. We're trying to get higher level and taking away the trends, understanding where it's going, and then sharing that back. For example, another way in which we've shared that back to our industry participants and our companies is we've been giving increased debt collection advisements to companies in California, instructing them on how they should and should not be collecting debt, not just mortgage debt, but general debt in California throughout the pandemic.
Perfect, thanks, Adam. So a lot of activity there. And once again, you're underlining through the use of your enhanced use of complaints data, the point that Supriya was making at the beginning of the session about the importance of collecting data and making use of it in a regulatory, to inform regulatory or supervisory approaches. Kirti, what about in Mauritius? What have been some of the changes from a regulatory or supervisory perspective that you've put into place at the Commission?
It was the main regulatory and supervisory changes were implemented mostly by the central bank. So during these days, just to recall that Mauritius comes under the purview of the National Payment Systems Act, also known as the NPS, which fall under the purview of the central bank. So the central bank did intervene, as I have already mentioned, to request banks to waive the interbank charges when it comes to card transactions and for cash withdrawals. So also the limits per item transactions, these were relaxed to allow for more electronic transactions to go through. And more importantly is that the payment system, despite the lockdown, continued to operate and showed its resilience. So all these activities were carried out remotely, but the whole of the payment system operated during the pandemic in order to allow interbank transactions to be carried out. So as there was the lockdown, banks did open during selected days and on selected locations, and albeit for a few hours, to allow people to carry out basic transactions. And at some point, at some time, to allow merchants to deposit cash so as they are not prone to theft. So at the level of the government, a number of initiatives were taken to limit the movement of people, yet to continue on the minimum level of financial activities. So government did continue to pay the benefits, for instance, the benefits to the pensioners, so that they have that comfort level of cash to be able to carry out the basic needs. So the main, action was taken mostly by the central bank, so as people can still do their activities and they have that level of comfort with their cash.
Terrific, thank you for that. And sort of flowing on from that question about changes that have been implemented as a result of the question, but as a result of the pandemic, but then looking very much to the future, and particularly, you know, the digital future, shall we say. So thinking about all the different sort of risks and analysis and experiences, as well as, you know, what you're seeing sort of generally in your jurisdiction, what do you think are some of the key regulatory or supervisory changes, or perhaps we've talked about some changes, perhaps areas of focus or activity that you, your organization will be thinking about in terms of protecting consumers in the years to come? And we've got Vasco back in the call, so perhaps Vasco, I could put this question to you first, please.
Thank you very much, Myers, and apologies for the problem with the internet here. I think before I mention some of the questions that we are looking to, I should mention that geopolitics can change, considerations can change everything. So perhaps for anyone watching this session in 1, 2, 3 years, may say that now how these people are naive or making these considerations. So everything can change. But I think that in a 1 year time frame, what we're going to focus on retail investors about the role of influencers, the social media influencers, and these social media trends on for investments. We saw that a lot of financial institutions are engaging with investors with new tools, social media tools, and also hiring social media influencers to provide advice on or financial information in which is what's used considered as a something boring, and now they can make that financial information available and it goes viral very fast. So it's good, but there's some considerations for regulators here, and especially with regards to broker dealer supervision. So the digital engagement practices of these broker dealers are offering sometimes game-like features and using behavior insights to design their platforms to encourage trading, as I mentioned before. So this is something that we are analyzing, and I think it's a common, it's a shared concern of among regulators. In the, I would say, 2, 3, 4 years, I think the crypto economy ecosystem will evolve, especially with the central banks issuing central bank digital coins. Soon, we will have a more complete ecosystem for crypto assets trading, so including cryptocurrency, digital currencies, sometimes issued by the central bank, and also people investing security tokens and perhaps non-fungible tokens. So this is something that we are working with the industry here. There's a law that's been discussing at the federal government, and perhaps the regulatory perimeters will be drawn soon. And my last, perhaps this is a long shot, it's the metaverse economy. As you know, a metaverse is an immersive, a shared immersive virtual world. It's nothing new, but the next generation of metaverses are being launched. They are being scaled up by Facebook through Meta and also facilitated by 5G communication. So the traditional metaverses, people are exchanging digital goods, digital services, or digital representation of physical goods and services. But usually these assets are there only. With the Meta and other platforms, you can have your own NFTs with you and perhaps go to another metaverse. So I think there is likely a trend to financial system to move into these new technologies. And this is something that, and it will involve ownership rights and the NFTs as records of digital ownership will be something that we'll definitely need to pay attention in perhaps in a 4 to 5 years time frame. Thank you.
Thanks, Vasco. Yes, it certainly seems that there's no end to the different permutations of financial product or product that can be enabled by digital technology these days. And as you say, it's a question of the regulatory perimeter and sort of how capable it is of accommodating these different things. And whether you can have broad principles that can be applied sort of at a specific level rather than necessarily sort of rewriting the law every time a new product comes on the market, which would be, you know, on a daily basis. So very interesting. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that, Vasco. Supriya, can I come to you next, please?
Thanks, Miles. So we are busy in Canada working to implement Canada's new financial consumer protection framework, which was enshrined in legislation a couple of years ago now. It contains about 60 new or enhanced measures to protect financial consumers. And it, I think, signals an important shift in focus from some more prescriptive regulation to regulation focused on better outcomes for consumers, which I think speaks to the point you were just making about, you know, are there broad principles, broad principle-based approaches that we can employ. But if you will allow me to zoom out for a second, I'll say, so, you know, 87% of Canadians now say that they manage their finances using the internet. So the biggest change in the financial sector, which is of course also the topic of this forum, is the digitalization of finance. And as per our current projections, we're sort of going to be developing an open banking framework for Canada within the next 1 year timeframe. So this is all very relevant and pertinent to us. And what I'll say there is that, you know, the and this is my sort of zoomed out perspective, but the digitalization of financial services, just like the digitalization of most aspects of our social or economic lives, is not a neutral force, right? On the one hand, new technology brings the potential for innovation to unlock tremendous value for financial consumers and solve seemingly intractable problems to make financial services infinitely more fair, more accessible, more inclusive. On the other hand, technology also tends to create new problems as it solves old ones. So fraud, exploitation, data breaches, algorithms that reinforce stereotypes and increase discrimination. I mean, I could go on, but I think the thing that we're really sort of grappling with in at the FCSE and in Canada broadly is what I'm about to say, which is that innovation is about making the status quo, is about questioning the status quo to make something better. And we need that. But making things better for some should not mean making them worse for others. So I will say our challenge as regulators in the next 1 to 3 year timeframe is really how, in the context of digitalization, how do we promote and even foster innovation for the benefits it can bring to consumers in the form of choice, access, inclusion, better product services, while making sure that consumers remain protected, particularly the most vulnerable. And then the second piece I'll add is, given what we've learned over the last 2 years, how do we make sure that what we've learned from COVID and what it has taught us about the critical importance of banking infrastructure during a crisis, how do we, you know, take that and ensure that these new online financial frameworks, if you will, or products, services, don't inadvertently increase barriers to access, again, especially for the most vulnerable. We think the best way to do this is to engage with and understand the financial consumer, either through research that we do directly or through consumer or through engaging with consumer advocacy organizations that can help us understand, you know, how we can work together to hopefully find the answers to these tough questions.
Thank you, Supriya. I really like what you said there about technology, digitalization, the benefits and the risks, but it's not a neutral force. Kirti, can I come to you next, please, in terms of your views about what's coming up next? What will the area of focus for the future?
Indeed, for Mauritius, we also see the emergence of other means of payment, basically those related to cryptos, where consumers could be very easily lured to, and therefore they could lose their investments depending on the way people save their products. So on the Mauritian context, we do have enshrined our laws the requirement to have the consumer education and consumer protection, taking both from the banking and non-banking regulators. At the level of the non-bank regulators, we have the mandate to of the Financial Services Commission to carry out financial literacy. And this is done through the Financial Services Fund, and they have got a full range of programs where they can reach out to the public, explaining the need to have a good financial education. So institutions seize every opportunity to talk to consumers about risk that happens into any product or anything that comes into the market. So what happens also with regards to the Financial Services Commission, it was not exactly due to the pandemic, but it just came during the pandemic, two new products that aims towards the digital finance of the mass. One was the peer-to-peer lending, and the other one is crowdfunding. both aim to be disruptors of the traditional banking systems of raising funds and are currently picking up. So we already have two operators in the peer-to-peer, and one in the crowdfunding. And we see that the interest is going on. And for the banks, for people to, it will help, it will be alternative for banks, like to the banks for people to raise money and even aid SMEs with respect to raising funds and doing business. So in future, the regulatory and supervisory changes will continue to evolve. Basically, we take a yearly approach to see what are the regulatory changes required, whether it is to protect or the consumers, or whether it is to come up with new products that will eventually enlarge the financial landscape. So going forward, the Commission, the Financial Services Commission, is coming with what we call the captive insurance business and the real estate investment trust. And we will also go in the area of licensing and service providers in the crypto and virtual assets areas. So, yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Kirti. So quite a lot on the horizon for you there. And Adam, let me bring that question to you finally.
Sure. Yeah. And echoing some statements I think others have made, which I think are terrific, in that, you know, California, we consider one of our strengths to be our diversity of our communities in California. And we believe going forward that one of our key focuses, and something that's going to animate all of our activities, is going to be ensuring that we are providers and that everyone in California is promoting financial inclusion and reducing barriers of access. Whether it comes to new Americans or student loan borrowers or those who are the most vulnerable, we are going to step up our expectations. And if we're going to make sure and do all that we can to make sure that systemic inequities are not furthered by these new changes that we're seeing across the markets, but only reduced. And that's definitely going to be something focused for us going forward.
Terrific. Thank you. Thank you so much, Adam. And thank you, everyone. That's sort of the end of our sort of formal or pre-planned questions that I had for our panelists. We've got a few questions in the chat. I think we've got time to respond to quickly. I might try and direct these based on the responses and the comments that panelists have made. So there's a first question from a colleague in South Korea asking about whether the development of crypto ecosystems will make financial systems more resilient to future shocks and in that way better protect consumers. And I thought I might direct this question to Vasco and to Kirti, because you both specifically talked about crypto. So do you see a potential of crypto ecosystems to actually play a beneficial role in terms of, I guess, the integrity of the system as a whole and therefore better consumer protection? Vasco, I don't know if you've got any thoughts or views about that.
I think, of course, there are risks, but also opportunities. It will depend on the regulation, especially also on law and the regulatory perimeter that needs to be clarified in some jurisdictions. I think crypto is a reality. Most Brazilians invest in crypto assets, and even with the perhaps some of the geopolitical considerations that I'm referring to will actually enhance this ecosystem. So it's being developed. We have a sandbox here at CVM, a regulatory sandbox, and all the four participants were working on crypto, using crypto to change the way securities are traded, are registered, are priced. So I think this is the, on my opinion, is the financial system of the future. So we cannot fight the future. We need to support investors and also to the financial innovation. So my last comment is that I fully agree with a new mandate for regulator, which is an innovation facilitator. Our economists needs there, and we need to be actually open to financial innovation in many areas. I think it will be beneficial if we can handle this complex problem very well.
Thanks, Vasco. And Kirti, from your perspective, do you see potential in the development of crypto to better protect the integrity of the system and the consumer?
Well, to add to what Vasco says, this is one part of the financial innovation ideas that we plan to do. And obviously, it is cryptos, there are other risks, and the regulators here to protect the consumers. And by having those regulation in place, we are here to ensure that the consumers are safe. But in terms of resilience, there will be a risk factor because nothing is 100% resilient, but it's just about minimizing the risk and ensuring that there is a certain level of protection and they feel safe, like when doing any sort of transaction. So the regulator is here to ensure that. And so, with the nowadays, everything, there has been an upsurge of interest in the cryptos. So the regulator cannot be blindfolded about that. So we need to ensure that we are going with what is happening, what are the changes happening around the world. So in terms of resilience, again, I say maybe it will be, it won't be fully resilient, but just about minimizing the risk. We will ensure that we do minimize the risk, any sort of risk.
Thank you. Thank you, Kirti. Thank you, Vasco. Another question we've received from CGAP, which I thought I would direct to Supriya because you touched on this. The question is, have you found new or different ways to communicate with consumer associations as a result of the pandemic to gain deeper or different insights into consumer risks in the market?
So we, last year, July of 2021, we launched a renewed national financial literacy strategy. And the focus of the strategy is also very much on outcomes for consumers. So it's very sort of research-based, very evidence-driven, and it has target outcomes in terms of increasing, you know, financial resilience. And it also speaks to actually strengthening consumer protection measures in the strategy itself. Through the the reason I bring it up here is the strategy is very much it endorses an ecosystem approach where we're saying that instead of placing the onus on the financial consumer, rather, so financial outcomes for consumers are a collective or mutual responsibility or shared responsibility, if you will, where the financial ecosystem around the consumer, so the regulator, the government, the financial industry, financial literacy organizations, academics, consumer advocacy, we all have to work together to make sure that we are changing the ecosystem in ways that will facilitate better outcomes for consumers. And those changes are either reducing barriers in the ecosystem or catalyzing actions in the ecosystem. So through this framework, if you will, yes, we have started very much to engage very strongly with all sorts of consumer organizations. I mean, this was happening earlier as well, but it was more in the context of engagement that was not as much targeted at behavioral outcomes as it now is through the national strategy. And we hope to continue to do this more and more for the next 5 years through the life of the strategy so we can get some data to see if this approach is helping people.
Thank you, Supriya. And the last question I have, which you've actually sort of answered in the context of your answer to that question, but I thought I might put this to Adam, given Adam, you mentioned financial inclusion. There's a question from a consumer rep in the Philippines asking about the challenges and opportunities of a strategy for financial inclusion when we have significant levels of financial exclusion. I mean, obviously they're different in different jurisdictions. Supriya, you've sort of touched on that, talking about barriers and addressing those barriers in the context of what you're doing in Canada. But Adam, at a California level, as you think about financial inclusion, what do you have a strategic approach in mind? How are you proposing perhaps to tackle that issue? Thank you.
Sure. There's probably two steps I'd want to highlight for how we're planning to go about it. First off is engagement. We have really stepped up our efforts in engaging with community members, consumer advocates, to make sure that we're seeing what's happening in these communities and to make sure that folks are able to share feedback with us. And so we are changing the way and enhancing the way we're meeting with people, open door policies, engaging with folks on Twitter and all platforms to make sure that we're responsive. And we're not just expecting folks to come to us. We're actively monitoring. We're trying to go where consumers are. So whether that's Reddit or App Store reviews or wherever it is, to try to make sure that we understand what's happening in our communities. But also research. We're investing in our research capabilities. We've recently hired a research department who's going to be spending time collecting data on how products are used and to make sure that we consider the communities who are using certain products as we go about regulating them. And so before we make decisions on whether or not a product should be tailored in a certain way or it needs to meet certain requirements, we want to make sure we understand who these products are serving. As we do that. And so for that, we need to have research, we need to have data. And so that's really two steps, engagement and research are two ways in which we hope to better get there.
Terrific, thank you, Adam. And that's been a bit of a theme throughout this session. And that brings us to the end of this session. I'd like to very much thank the four panelists. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts and perspectives so generously today. I see a comment in the chat, which I think sort of sums up part of the discussion and saved me from doing that. Kimura says, we need to scale up safe, transparent and responsive digital services and infrastructures. And I think all of our panelists have sort of touched on that theme very much so. So thank you, Kimura, for helping me to summarize. So thank you so much. I think I'm handing back to Matt from Consumers International. Thank you very much and have a good rest of the day, everybody, and a good rest of the forum to consume.